Hello, everybody. Charisse here with a very special announcement. I am thrilled to share that RCAT is now an official AIA continuing education provider. With this remarkable distinction, RCAT has launched RCATemy, a continuing education platform for the busy AEC professional. And here's the really exciting part. You can now earn continuing education credits by doing exactly what you are doing right now. That's right, you can now earn AIA credits by listening to select episodes of Detail. Whether you're working around the house, on your commute, or stuck in a waiting room, just listen, take a brief quiz, and your credit will automatically be recorded with AIA. It's really that simple. Plus, bonus points that much of our content qualifies for that elusive HSW credit. And we all know how valuable those are. What more could you ask for? We aim to please. Find out more at rcat.com/continuing-education or follow the link in our show notes. And thank you for tuning in to the RCAT Detailed podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
It's a very multifaceted architecture that is very functional, but it's very fitting because it has a very multifunctional purpose. Many different sports, creating a home for the kids, for youth, doing education, being a social hub, and I don't think that could be done with a big A museum or something like that. I think it needs to be playful.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, Senior Specification Writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Stefan Banish, founder of Banish Architekten, with offices in Stuttgart, Boston, Munich, and Weimar. Stefan Banish, born in 1957 in Stuttgart, studied philosophy, economics, and architecture. He is the founding partner of Banish Architekten in Germany. He is a world-renowned advocate and educator of sustainable building design and has lectured at conferences all over the world. I know this because I've actually met him. Banish's goal, to connect the forces of human life and the natural environment, fuels the design of every commission his firm receives. Since founding Banish & Partner in 1989, now Banish Architekten, Stefan has directed the design of dynamic, award-winning buildings that promote sustainability within the built environment. With a design portfolio that includes master planning, public buildings, healthcare clinics, sports facilities, redevelopment, offices, schools, and museums, he strives to design inclusive buildings that provide maximum benefit to all users. His innovative approach to sustainable architecture is highly acknowledged in Europe, North America, and all over the world. And his buildings have been honored by prestigious institutions and industry organizations alike. The project we will be talking about today is the Action Sports Center in Mönchengladbach, Germany. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. The Action Sports Center in Munich was created to meet a growing need for a space where people could enjoy extreme sports like skateboarding, BMX, and parkour on their own terms. From the beginning, the project was shaped with the help of future users, who worked closely with the city's Department of Education and Sports to design a space that reflects their needs and ideas.
Sports in your country is always perceived very competitive. It is a possibility to either be a star, or who doesn't want to be a star? But it is also a possibility to get into a university, in a good school. So it's almost often perceived as a tool. And also, it is only appreciated if you are in the top tier of your sports. Here, sports is perceived as for children at least, but also for young people or even old ones, as a public good. It's perceived as part of education. It's perceived as enhancing living quality. And we pay taxes to enhance also our living quality. So, swimming pools are public funded. Soccer places are publicly funded. Sports clubs, Vereine, are a private initiative but publicly supported with public money. Same thing as our theaters and concert halls and operas are publicly funded. It is a different system. We do pay higher taxes, but we get a lot out of it. It's not as good as Denmark, but it's okay here. So the city of Munich knows the best way to get the kids off the dark areas of the street is giving them an area where they can play in a safer environment and where we can control not them, but the environment they are exposed to. That's a huge difference. So the city of Munich said, we have 60 soccer clubs. We have 20 public pools. But what is with the kids that do these kind of modern young sports? I call it that. It's not young anymore. The best skateboarders are in their mid-30s. But still, you know what I mean. These not so established mainstream sports. Let's build something for them. And it's interesting because they looked for an area, a building or place where they could place it and found this old factory building. Finished exactly 1900. Historic listed building. But the program asked for far more than they originally, than the building can house. And they said, okay, this is a historic building. Nobody can use it really, but let's restore it so we can keep it for the next generations. So it's sort of double dipping. You do a sports hall, but you also take care of one of your listed fantastic buildings. And then the second part is an extension to it. But since this is for not mainstream sports, it took a long time because whenever they needed to cut somewhere budget, it usually goes there. Let me talk briefly about my youth here in Stuttgart, because we had the same issue. We had an area newly developed with a big traffic crossover in the city of Sendo. Stuttgart always perceived itself as a car town, a bit like LA, yeah? So, but in a valley, actually idiotic, doesn't work, but still. And so this elevated platform with buildings on it and bars was a disaster, a failure. And then the young people took it over. And then they started using these tunnels for skateboarders. Because the tramway that went through stopped, didn't go through anymore. But the car still went through. And the skaters were next to it in the tunnel. So it was called the gas chamber. Because they were skating next to the cars. And then the city noticed there is a need. There's a vacancy. And then they created another space for them. So Munich, similar. When they noticed there is a need, the kids are somewhere skating, but it's unsafe for them and everybody else. Then the city notices we need to create a space. Same thing in Stuttgart as in Munich. Now, it's also a stupid perception. It's sort of reversing act and reaction. It's always, they always think, oh, the kids, they don't give a place for the kids. So the kids go somewhere where they don't get hassled. And that's usually the darkest corner of the city. And then all the bad stuff comes there because there are kids. So it's sort of give them an opportunity, give them a safe place, let them run on benches, let them spray paint. Who cares? But give them a safe environment. That's all that counts.
This center, however, is much more than a sports hall. At its core is a commitment to inclusion.
It's really inclusion, and that inclusion goes to that kids on wheelchairs could use the skate part. There's a natural border to it. I mean, they can't do parkour, but they can do a lot of these sports in their own way. And it should be so inclusive that they can watch each other, they can include each other, and that at times the wheelchair kids can use it, at times others. It should be really for everybody. It should be for abled, disabled, of all cultures, bicycle, the skateboard, the parkour. And the funny thing is, it's a little bit like the surfers. They are sort of tribes, different tribes. You know that. Try to go surfing in Malibu if you are not part of the tribe. Yeah? It can end deadly. Yeah? So, and the idea is to create an environment that they all can coexist there. That's the inclusion part. Rich, poor, socially challenged, you know, well-educated, German, non-German, male, female, wop, all together. It should be, the interesting thing is that the young people are often not yet spoiled, not yet rotten. They can really accept each other without limits and prejudices. And that's a little bit getting difficult with the right-wing movement also here, because they are targeting the young. But at the time being, I would say things like that can enhance the tolerance and the living together.
The design of the Action Sports Center unfolds in two phases. The first transforms a historic industrial building into a dynamic skate and BMX park with integrated amenities and an observation terrace. The second will introduce a parkour area and a cafe. Throughout, sustainability remains a guiding principle.
There is a first stage and a second stage of this project. The first stage is the historic hall with some containers next to it for restrooms, coffee shop, stuff like that, and some admin. And they can move to another place when stage two comes. In the first stage, we have mainly skateboard and some BMX and stuff like that. Yeah, that's mainly. And we have built in a terrace for people to watch it that is built in. It's a big steel structure, a yellow steel structure. People can hang out and watch and have, you know, have some water or coffee or whatever it is. So the first step is relatively open. You can do a lot of these action sports, and it has some specialized areas like skateboard or BMX and so on. But it gets really interesting and bigger. I mean, this is about 15,000 square feet, roughly, cross floor area. But when the second stage comes, there we have a lot more. We have then BMX, skateboard together with the first stage, parkour, which is very complex to build, and rollerblades, whatever. Many, many different kinds of these sports in there. And then also a sort of a cafeteria will come as well in the second stage. Both stages are, and that was very important for the city, very sustainable, very low energy, very comfortable. The second stage is in wood. The first stage reused mostly existing areas and materials. And everything that is built in excess, like the containers, should be reusable.
The building itself tells a story. Housed in the former Eggen Fabrik, a heritage-listed structure from around 1900, the center preserves the character of the original factory, including its striking gabled facades and delicate steel framework.
We could keep most of the structure. The steel structure, the fine steel structure, it's almost Eiffel, yeah, fine steel structure. But we had, for example, they had some cladding on the roofs. We had to change that to very light precast concrete sort of boards sitting on there. So we needed to strengthen it a little bit. What we had a very good structural engineer, you don't see the difference. He just added one bar, small bar. So it's very well done. So it is a historic monument, a listed building. So whatever we did, we had to go through the department responsible for historic buildings. But they're okay. They're pretty good. You can work with them. For example, we took the old skylights out, did put new skylights in, and to avoid overheating, we did put photovoltaic in the skylights. So they create sort of a half shade, half light. They cover about 60-70%, and 30% light comes still through. That was calculated, how much should it be. So we worked even with very contemporary means to enhance and restore the historic building. And, for example, we have a ventilation system in there, but it's a very passive building. There is no AC in anything, only a ventilation system where we can blow fresh air in summer through. The historic basis was solid and was good. And even if we would have built it from new, this part wouldn't have been that different because it's an industrial hall. And what is more suitable for this kind of sports than an industrial hall? So it's just a historic industrial hall, but still it's one.
Is this a place that's easy for the kids to get to?
Oh, yeah. It's very easy to get to. There is a new bicycle road. We have now in these bigger cities these bicycle expressways that go from suburb to city center, point to point. And it's right on one of these expressways. So the bicycle infrastructure is very good. The new subway line is under construction and will have a station very close by. The railway, the S-Bahn commuter train, has a station very close by. So publicly, easily reachable. With private car, difficult, no parking.
To fully integrate inclusivity in the many respective sports housed within the project, Stefan and his team consulted with specialists and social workers closely tied to the young athlete community.
You talk to specialists, social workers who work with the kids. Then, for example, skateboarding is probably a pretty far developed kind of sports. A little bit like breakdance and so on. It's pretty far developed. And there are consultants even that design tracks. They design the balls. And we talked to them. In the end, we ended up designing our own ones with their help because they never could make up their mind. They were in endless discussions. But with the help, we designed them. I had younger people on the job also. Maria Hinsberger, who is a partner from me in Munich, but she is far younger, and she was responsible before she became partner for this project. And they watched, they visited venues, they talked to people to understand what this all is about. Because a lot of this stuff, I didn't know what it is. I still don't know. Yeah, but it's, you first need to understand how they tick, what they do. And as I said before, it is here not competitive. You don't have to fulfill a norm. What you have to do is create a space where they really can play and work and do sports. And it's for them very serious. This is not a game. It's really serious. But you need to learn that. But, you know, if you do a cancer research center, you need to learn what they do. Same thing.
So I'm going to test you a little bit here. Did you go out and get on a skateboard?
Oh, I used to skate.
Oh, okay.
I used to skate. First of all, I lived for a while in Venice, California.
You have to skate if you live in Venice.
You have, yeah. Back in the 80s, the beach was a bit dangerous, yeah. But I did skate as a kid. And then, oh, young man also. At one point when I had kids, I stopped it. And then my kids started it, yeah. So I'm familiar with that. I bike, so I'm familiar with that. But parkour, I'm too old and too heavy.
Despite his own background in skateboarding, Stefan and his team faced a steep learning curve as they worked to integrate inclusive design while managing the project budget in coordination with the city of Munich.
In the beginning, you think you know what it's about. And you talk to them and you think, yeah, I know. Okay, let's go on with it. And then here especially I noticed, the further I went, since, to be honest, most of my knowledge, except bike and skating, is from movies. Parkour and this stuff. That's most of my knowledge in these extreme sports. And then I noticed, it took me half a year to notice that we are rather clueless. That we thought we know it, but that it's far more complex. And the process was far more complex. I mean, to get these people to agree on something, and the client was okay, the city, but they sort of took the back seat and watched us. And the only thing they raised their hand was sort of when we said, we need that and that and that. How much is it? And we said, oh, that's an extra 100,000. And we said, oh, yeah, okay. I have to say something about the city of Munich, which is very unusual, also in Germany and in US, totally unheard of. When you design a project for the city of Munich municipality, project like that or a school, costs in the beginning is you do a calculation, you ask for a budget, they add 20% to it. And then they say, unless the program changes, don't come back. And then if the program changes, you have a good excuse, not a problem. It's very clever because they all deliver their projects 10% below budget. So they are all heroes. And politicians are anyway totally clueless because what do they know what it costs to build a building? They only compare it to the numbers they know. But the problem we architects always create is we don't deliver true costs. We always cheat to get it through. If we would get them used to a higher benchmark, we would have the same issue. It wouldn't be a problem. So Munich, because they know of this problem and they know architects are wimps, they always add 20% to the budget and tell us, don't come back without a good excuse. So here, same thing, learning curve for us, but covered in the budget.
Rather than demolish and rebuild, the project team preserved most of the existing shell, replacing only the roof with a sustainable timber ceiling. This approach not only maintained the building's charm, but also reduced environmental impact.
First of all, it's not totally up to current codes. But since it's a listed building, they give you some slack there. We had to improve the structure, as I described before, because we got more load on the roof. Yeah. That's one thing. Then we had to insulate the building, but we kept all the walls. And we also kept the framing of the historic windows at the front and back. And that was quite challenging to develop with companies an insulated window that actually fits in there, also from the weight and everything. So the frame of the building is historic, 1900s. Also the walls, all the supporting system, partly enhanced, but generally. But then we had to insulate it at the outside, and that were long discussions. What can we do? What should we do? And we agreed with them to insulate the roof and the side walls and the back wall, but not the front wall. No insulation at the front wall because there is the historic wall with all the elements, and we wanted to keep that. So that is not insulated. Then we had a huge challenge with the acoustic because the building is almost like a cupola, a tunnel. And we all know when you have rounded spaces, you get a big echo. It's getting very noisy. So we had to put sound buffers at the walls, for example. But there is not that much to this building, technically, or physically material. But there is a lot of planning in there, of design and engineering. Great engineers worked with us on that. There's a lot of engineering because it's always easy to build from scratch, to knock something down and build something there. It's far more difficult if you have something and want to bring it in a usable state, but use as minimal material and effort as possible. The design effort is far greater.
The ground floor skate park features a thoughtfully crafted blend of materials, including plaster, concrete, foam, wooden forms, and rebar, integrated throughout the design.
The skateboard. In the beginning, we planned to do it out of plywood. You can do it out of plywood. You can form it. But then it turned out to be not durable enough. So it is mostly foam forms, wooden forms, Schablone. I don't know, you know, the form. So you get the right form. And plaster, concrete, rebar. It is a very mixed and very craftsy construction. A lot of handwork to do that. Because it has to be exactly, you know, if you do too much of a edge, the skateboards don't stay clear of it. So everything is very calculated and constructed with forms. So it's ideal for the skateboarders. And that was, since it's three-dimensional and you can't use brick or something like that. I mean, it's all craftsmanship. It is a lot of different materials, very complex, also hollow spaces below it. But yeah, it was an interesting experience because it's nothing like I had done it before.
A new gallery level overlooks the activity below, doubling as a lounge and event space. Along the west side, integrated niches provide seating and storage for users.
There is seating along the walls with, you know, some cabinets and seating benches. And then on the mezzanine gallery that spans clear over the width of the hall, there's also some areas to stand and watch. No seating, but to stand and watch. But the main seating for the kids and for spectators are along the side walls where you can watch.
Well, and one of the things, the listeners can go look at the pictures, but one of the reasons I asked you that question is I love the way that you had the insets in the walls for that seating. So many places, even, you know, gymnasiums and things like that will just have benches against a flat wall. And it almost gets in the way sometimes of the sporting field. And I love the way that you set that back a little bit from the actual space of the field and worked in a little storage there as well. You know, I thought that was pretty genius.
It's sort of a niche, but that is sort of also was a little bit dedicated by the structure, because the structure gave us some depth and we were able to create these niches with the seating, but also storage space. You can't do too much of that because of fire regulations, non-combustible materials and so on. But this creates a rather personal and almost homey atmosphere. So it's not really spectator seating. It's more for the kids, for the athletes, for the break, so they can store their stuff. But then there are also the cones, you know, to create a course and stuff like that.
The MEP design keeps things simple and efficient. Natural ventilation cools the building, and solar panels on the skylights help generate power while blocking too much sun.
The first architectural decision was to keep it exposed. Don't even try to hide it. We had the big advantage that the building is connected to the district heating system. And Munich's district heating is supposed to be 80% geothermal in something like 10, 15 years. It's already up there 30%. So it's a very low emission heating system. So this is good. This helped us, yeah, a lot. And then we have exposed the ventilation pipes we need. I mean, we needed the ventilation pipes for different things. Mainly first, but that could be done purely natural. And it's done mostly natural by opening roof and front windows to keep the air fresh. But then we need a ventilation system for winter and especially to smoke extract, if there's a fire in there or so, to really blow out, yeah? And this is pretty in your face system. It's tubes, yellow, hanging in there. No hiding, no integration, nothing. They are part of this old factory structure. That was the system. It's not very complex, but it does a lot of the necessary things. Ideally, in summer, let's say in the time between March and October, you can run it pure natural ventilation.
Looking ahead, a second construction phase will bring even more to the site. A skate bowl, parkour area, dirt bike jumps, and a cafe with a terrace. Supporting facilities, like restrooms, are housed in mobile containers that can be repositioned during future expansion.
We have done for both projects a DD already. So phase two is designed already, part of the design. And it was decided originally they wanted to build them together, but then we had one of our 100 financial crises, yeah? But then they decided to first do one, and now they've decided to do phase two. It's going to come in 2-3 years. So the containers, we added these containers that house the cafeteria, the toilets, and so on, and some office space and changing facilities. We added to the first phase, but in containers that will, when phase two comes, phase two will be directly connected to the hall where now the containers are, and they will be moved to a different place and become part of phase two. So nothing goes to waste. Everything will be usable, and part of the infrastructure of phase two is already laid out there and built there. So we have done a garden now and planting, but we have done it in a way that the trees, if it happens within the next 5-6 years, the trees can be moved to another place. The idea is not to destroy anything we have done and built to build phase two. So it's fully integrated already.
So those containers, when you move them for phase two, will they remain being used for what they're being used for right now? And you're just going to move them around to make it all?
Yeah, they go to a different place and they will partly be extended, for example, changing facilities and so on. So some elements, like the cafeteria, which is right now a rather lame thing in one of the containers, will then move fully in phase two. And phase two so far is a wooden sphere, I would say, partly cladded with glass, photovoltaics, and so on. It's almost a little bit like one of these. In California, they did them a lot, these domes, these buildings. There was a special term for that. Something dome, doesn't matter. It's a little bit Buckminster Fuller kind of thing. And this will be the skin of the building, and there will be a sort of a freestanding concrete table, three stories in there. if we build it in 1-2 years, maybe the concrete table will become a steel table or wooden table, because we tried now to avoid concrete as much as possible.
Unlike construction in the United States, this project omits cooperation with general contractors and instead focuses on individual trades with careful management on site. This means several contracts must be navigated during the construction phase.
We have a little bit of a different system here. We hardly work with general contractors. We don't know construction management. We work with the individual trades, and we as architects manage the trades on site.
Wow. Oh, wow. I did not know that.
We work in a so-called multi-stage contracting. A project like that, we do, and we also do our own tender documents. We don't have spec writers. We don't have hardware consultants. It's a very different tradition here in this case. But because I know both US and Germany, you know, and I know that, I would say on a project like that, in average, we manage about 40 different contracts. Yeah, the bricklayer is a different one from the street people, from the drywallers, from the electricians, from the MEP, from the water people, whatever it is. So often, sometimes we have this sort of combined contracting. That means we have 4 to 8 different contracts on site. This is sort of all mechanics is one contractor, including electricity. Building skin is one contractor. Concrete is one. Earth is one, and so on. Drywall, and so on. Interior is one. But on these projects, especially these fine little projects, we plan everything. We tender everything separate. And we need at least 3 offers before we can hire them. And then we manage them on site and do site supervision. Or sometimes we hire an architect who is specialized on doing that. It's very different from US. But therefore, we also control the costs from the beginning to the end. There is nobody involved, cost consultant or anything. That's all our job. So it's very different how we go about that. On a bigger project, like, I don't know, Lord LB or so, we have something like 250 different contracts to manage on site. Sometimes same company having 2 or 3 contracts, but still, yeah, you know how many trades a building has, and usually each trade is a different contract. So it is work. We get paid for it. It is extra work, but you have a lot of quality control. And you can make sure the facade doesn't go on before the concrete is dry and finished and doesn't mess up your facade. So that's how it works. And actually, it is fun.
For Stefan, the project's complexity and multifaceted nature set it apart from conventional architectural work. And that's precisely what makes it so compelling.
I would say I'm very proud of how we dealt with the historic building. I think the people who worked on it in my office, especially Maria Hansberger, were very attentive to the needs of the kids, young people. And I would say, if it's finished, to go full circle, I think this building will be what it wants to be. Let's talk for a second pure architecture, you know, with a very big A. It is not. It's almost a mess because there is the historic hall, the containers, the new extension, It's a very multifaceted architecture that is very functional, but it's very fitting because it has a very multifunctional purpose. Many different sports, creating a home for the kids, for youth, doing education, being a social hub. And I don't think that could be done with a big A museum or something like that. I think it needs to be playful.
So I don't know, maybe I'm an outlier here, but for me, that big A isn't the fancy museum. I'm not saying that couldn't be included, but that big A is when you fully create that thing that your client needs or that building needs to be, to the point that those people walking into that space feel it the way they're supposed to feel it. And when you've done that, you're a success. You can create a big, gorgeous hotel or skyscraper or whatever the big A kind of projects are. But if it doesn't meet the true need that you were tasked with in the first place. And I've been in buildings that are supposed to be amazing that I've thought, this is the stupidest thing I've ever been in. You know, somebody worked way too hard to make a statement that they forgot that then now I'm going to walk in there and want it to serve whatever purpose it's supposed to serve.
Agreed. I totally agree. That's also my understanding of architecture. But most people perceive a big A as a formal statement, architectural formal statement. And this is not. This is, as I said, almost a mess. But it is designed that way, purposely designed. It didn't happen. It's purposely designed that way because it should not alienate. It should be home for everybody. It should not be formal. It should not intimidate. It should be almost like, ideally, we just would put a circus tent there. That would be the ideal solution. Not possible because of weather and durability and so on, but that's kind of the atmosphere we wanted. And I think they succeeded in doing that. I mean, I haven't done it. It's my office, but the people who have worked on it, Maria and her crew, they did a superb job there. That's the advantage. If you work for the public, they don't have to sell it to anybody. If you work for an investor, he or she would even try to make this a statement because it looks better on the rendering and in the brochure. It sells better. Yeah, that's a little bit the challenge of the PPP project, public-private partnership projects, that there is always a different agenda. And here, when you work for the public, where you deal with people who personally cannot gain and lose, you can really cut to the bone of things.
Even with a project of this modest scale, the complexity of accommodating so many different cultures and opinions proved a vital lesson.
One lesson learned definitely was the complexity of different challenges on a relatively small project. And that's technically, architecturally, and working for this kind of complex, multifaceted use. It's funny, when you go in interviews for a new job, and you take your lab consultant with you because everybody thinks building a lab building is so complex, they make it this magic science. Harmless. building a thing like that is complex, far more complex, because you don't deal with tubes, with steel, with gases, with refrigerators, with autoclave. You deal with a bunch of kids that have all their opinion.
In the end, the Action Sports Center represents far more than a place for tricks and jumps. It's a vibrant hub where sustainability, heritage, and community all come together, showing what's possible when a city listens, includes, and builds with purpose. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious why it was so important to Stefan to connect the forces of human life and the natural environment in his projects.
I come from a very liberal family. My father was a very well-known architect in Germany. And after I had finished school, I didn't know what to do. Everybody expected me to become an architect. There was a very good reason not to do it. And so I studied philosophy with the Jesuits. I'm not Catholic, by the way. But I studied with them because they teach philosophy as the mother of all sciences. And there I learned that whatever we do, whatever we start, there's always action and reaction. We always influence. So since it's the same effort to build a stupid building, you might as well build a good building. And I always, and I'm still of the opinion, you need to do what you're convinced about. And we had that in discussion in the office often and a long time. What are we willing to do? What are we willing for whom to do? Who do we want to work with? And what should be the outcome of our work? And that's where the statement is.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Stefan. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires some mark that you want to leave on this world.
Personal, that my wife and I managed to give our offspring a possibility to develop a good life for themselves and give them the convictions we have, we share, teach them the convictions. Professionally, I've done many buildings. I don't think they are really the legacy. They're fine, and it's fun to go somewhere and see old buildings. That's a vanity thing. I think the impact is that the young coming architects who worked with me, we educated in our office, understand that, for example, to work for a more sustainable built environment is a learning process we'll never achieve. We'll never really, the stone of wisdom, you know, the holy grail doesn't exist. It's everything is in process. Everything is fluid. And we need to understand that our goal is actually to make it better, but to be open, to acknowledge that each and every time we get a new task, the whole set will be new defined. The state of the art is newly defined. The situation, the program, the political context, the climatic context, geographical context, and so on, social context is always new defined, and it's an ongoing learning process. And if they get that and live the professional life that way, that's fine.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.